And among those things, I know he talked about was things your mom and dad talked about a lot, which is just making sure everybody got the decent shot. I remember 8 or 9 years ago, right before the financial crisis, you were saying working people in this country weren't getting a decent shot. That's why you were doing this. That's what you're fighting for.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask you, we now see this eruption around the world of people very frustrated, and the things your son fought for and your dad and mom stood for are being undermined. And it's something you've spoken out a lot about. How does that explain the frustration we're all feeling today?
The honest answer is, I'm not sure, but it's an old joke. I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. I think it's a couple things. Number one, I think those people outside are getting wet, so they ought to come in. You ought to let them in the house here.
Use this one, too.
Yeah, I think you ought to all come in.
Is there a way we can bring people in?
A little bit.
Put them in the aisle if it's allowed. Yeah.
I think a couple things. There used to be a basic bargain, in my view. A basic bargain in the country that existed at least from the late 30s on. Democrats and Republicans shared the view. And that is that if you contributed to the profitability of the enterprise you were part of, you got to share in the benefits that flowed from that. And Republicans felt strongly about that. That was sort of the basic bargain. And as a practical matter, that bargain hasn't been sustained now. You can argue about the details, and there are those who criticize that, but there was a study done at the University of Massachusetts, published in Harvard Business Journal, where 447 of the, and I come from the corporate state of Delaware. I got elected 7 times. I love Bernie. I ain't Bernie. What happened was that those 447 who had been in the Fortune 500 for that entire time, they made $2.7 trillion in profit. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. But what happened was they spent 53% of that profit buying back their own stock, and they spent 37% on dividends and 9% for everything else, research, development, expansion, etc. There's a lot of reasons for that, globalization, a whole bunch of other things. But the bottom line was, if I have a cartoon in my office that my staff keeps trying to put away. It's I think you've seen it, David. It's a picture of out of the New Yorker, a picture of a guy, a rotund guy in a black turtleneck sweater, black mask, a beret, big bag of money on the table, being interrogated. And he says, how was I supposed to know he was a job creator? my dad sold automobiles. He was a job creator for General Motors. Used to be the highest paid people in corporate America beyond the top executives were the sales personnel. They created jobs. They sold the product, etc. That's not the case now. And it's not any cabal, it's not any great conspiracy, it's a consequence of 1,000 little changes that have taken place that I think you're finding an awful lot of people, not only here but around the world, are beginning to rethink. I met with 5 of the, 25 CEOs of the 25 largest companies, and the guy who runs the largest management fund, over $7 trillion. They wanted to meet with me privately about corporate responsibility and reestablishing what constitutes corporate responsibility. And what happens is people don't think they're part of the deal anymore. And the nature of the financial crisis, in my view, which was not any one person's making, but what happened was you got a guy who never missed a mortgage payment. Living in a neighborhood where 3 guys got those cockamamie mortgages, their lawns turned brown. What happened was they were foreclosed on. All of a sudden, they lost their home because they were underwater. You found people walking in as a consequence of the crisis who just gotten a corporate, they got their early review. They got great marks and say, give me your computer card. You're done. So people felt like they were helpless, I think, in terms of what happened to them. And I don't think any of us have spoken as clearly to their fears and their aspirations as is necessary to let them know that it really matters. I know in Washington, a lot of you guys refer to me as middle class. Okay, that's the handle. And in Washington, that means, as you all know, you're all sophisticated. If you're middle class, you can't be that sophisticated. That's what they're talking about with me. But I tell you one thing, the reason I talk about the middle class so much, it's not about fairness alone. It's about stability. As long as the middle class is growing, we have a social and political stability in this country. And it's been sustained over the last 100 years because the middle class has been more stable than any other place in the world. It is the element of our ability to continue to have this aspirational notion that anything is possible in the country. And if you notice, they're losing that sense of possibility now. And there's no easy answer to it. But failing to speak to it, failing to acknowledge it, failing to indicate, I always say to my staff, if you write me a speech, make sure that the first thing that I communicate is I understand what you're worried about. I understand your problem. And I don't think any of us have spoken very well to that concern. And so, but you're seeing it around the world. And anyway.
You're seeing it. That's all right. You're seeing it around the world, but especially in this country, especially the Trump voters, rejecting immigration, rejecting trade, rejecting some technological progress. Do we have to rethink our trade agreements? Do we have to rethink immigration? Or do we have to explain better what we stand for?
I think a little of both. That's not a problem. I was just in Ireland. And it's the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, 1916. And there's a line in Yeats's poem. You know, I know Senator Warner and others know I'd always quote Irish poets on the floor of the Senate. They all think I did it because I'm Irish. That's not the reason. I did it because they're the best poets. There's a line in his poem that he was describing his Ireland in 1916 that I think better describes the world today that we find ourselves in than it did his Ireland in 1916. It says, all's changed. Changed utterly. A terrible beauty has been born. All's changed. Changed utterly. A terrible beauty has been born. All has changed in the last 15 years. In fundamental ways. And it always takes governments in every moment of inflection, probably five in our history, it always requires government to taking time to catch up with the change that has occurred. And so people are having great difficulty understanding, and we're having great difficulty absorbing some of the changes that have taken place. We no longer are immediately concerned about two major wars on two fronts. We're talking about stateless actors around the world who are wreaking havoc on us. And in consequence of that, they're also generating a kind of fear and apprehension that if we play to that fear, it can eat us alive. There's no existential threat to the United States from Al-Qaeda. There's reason to worry, but there's no existential threat. Yet if it's easy to play on it. I can play on that fear that if, in fact, at any restaurant you go to in an upscale place like Aspen, what could happen to you, what just happened in Bangladesh in an upscale bakery, the likelihood of that happening, or like us being struck by lightning and all killed here. Possible, not likely. Not likely. But it seems to me it matters. It matters how political leaders speak to these things. It matters how we talk about it. And the truth is, some trade agreements have hurt certain industries, have hurt workers in certain places, but there has always been that transitional requirement when every new revolution comes along. We're kind of in the fourth industrial revolution right now. And government has to figure out how to manage those changes to provide for and respond to the possibilities that everybody is going to have a chance to be treated with dignity and being able to make a living. And right now, people are worried about that because we are, even the best thinkers in the country are not exactly sure exactly which way to go. And so, for example, TPP. TPP, from my perspective, is a more important foreign policy document than it is an economic tool. If we abandon the region of Asia, where 45% of the world's GDP is, just the sheer weight, size, and influence of China will have a gigantic impact on the nations with no other place to turn. But have we negotiated the toughest? Have we negotiated the most reasonable agreement? People can argue about that. But the idea that we can move away from enhancing trade and tying nations closer together is a denial of historical trends. And so I'm not sure that answers your question, but I think we have to explain it better, but acknowledge. Look, one of the things, in my view, we have to do is when intelligent, hardworking Americans express a fear, an anxiety that has legitimacy to it, we have an obligation to respond to it, not act like we know better, not act like that we have, there's a clear, unequivocal answer. We've got to engage them. And I don't think we do it enough. I don't think we, because we are, and I think part of the reason is, and I don't know whether my Republican friends will agree, but our politics is more divided than our people are right now. The difference between when Newt was Speaker and I was in the Senate is that as strongly as we disagreed, we actually talked with one another. We actually trusted each other. We trusted each other when you gave your hand that would be a deal. We used to actually get to know one another. Sadly, I went into, Amy, I didn't realize you guys don't have a private Senate dining room anymore. The dining room that used to be, there was a Senate dining room and then a private one with two great big conference tables. When I first got to the Senate, I didn't want to be there, and Ted Kennedy dragged me over and said, "You want to learn about the Senate? Make sure you sit here for an hour and a half every day." All the senior members came in, Democrat and Republican. They talked to us. The only place we did business. And everybody, you'd hear the old stories. You'd talk about strategy. You got to know one another. You travel with one another. When you learn that your colleague has a wife with breast cancer or a colleague has a son who's suffering from a drug problem, or that their mother has Alzheimer's, or they're dealing with a serious problem, it's awful hard to dislike them. It's awful hard to ascribe negative motive to everything they do. And you actually, it takes the edge off of real differences. When I got to the Senate, there were more substantive differences than exist today. The war in Vietnam was raging. The women's movement and civil rights were just combustible. There were so many things, but yet you actually spoke to one another. I'll end by saying the best lesson I ever learned. I got to the Senate when I was 20. I was elected when I was 29. And right afterwards, there was an accident where a tractor trailer
broadside at my wife and daughter's car, my two kids, and kill my wife and daughter, and my two boys were badly injured. And so I didn't want to go to the Senate. And a lot of the senior guys came to see me, including guys like Saxby and Stevens of Alaska, not just Democrats. And you remember this. And they said, come on down, just stay 6 months. We need you to organize. I was the first United States senator I ever knew. I didn't know they didn't need me. There was a Democratic governor. There were 58 Democratic senators. They didn't need me at all. But it basically saved my sanity. And I know I went down, and what I have to do is every single Tuesday at 3 o'clock, I went to Senator Mansfield's office. He was the leader of the Senate from Montana, Iron Mike Mansfield. I don't think any of my colleagues there would say a single person ever doubted his integrity or his character. And he'd give me an assignment. And I thought all freshmen got assignments. No, I'm serious. I thought they did. And he'd give me an assignment. But what he was really doing, I learned about 5 months in, I figured out, was just sort of taking my pulse. How am I doing? How are you doing? And one day I walked in the Senate floor for my 3 o'clock meeting, and I got off the elevators, walked through those double doors down to the well of the Senate, where I'd always check when the last vote was so I could take the train home and see my kid, my boys. And Jesse Helms, who I ended up working with a long, long time, was on the floor excoriating Ted Kennedy and a guy who I consider a very close personal friend, Bob Dole, who I still keep in close contact with, for the precursor to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it was basically was, why the hell should the public have to pay for curb cuts? I'm exaggerating to make a point. But it was all about those with handicaps. And anyway, so I walked in. Fortunately, I couldn't stop because I was more afraid of missing Mansfield. I probably would have said something, not that I've ever said anything in politics, but I probably would have said something very stupid. And I walked in, I sat across from Mansfield's desk, and I'd always sit across from the desk. And he always had remember that corncob pipe he had? Hardly ever lighted, but he had it in his hand all the time. And he looked at me and he said, in little clip tones, he said, what's the matter, Joe? And I went on, what probably was 3 minutes, probably sounded like an hour. I went on after Jesse Helms. I said, he has no social redeeming value. This guy is not. I really went after his on a motive. And he waited till I finished. He looked at me. He said, Joe, it's an absolute true story. My word is abiding. He said, what would you say, Joe, if I told you in 1970, sitting in the living room in Raleigh, Dodd Helms and Jesse Helms are reading an advertisement in the Raleigh Observer. And there's a picture of a young boy. I think he was 14, Joe, with metal braces up to his hips on both legs and steel crutches, saying, all I want for Christmas is someone to love me and take me home. So what would you say, Joe, if I told you Jesse and Dodd Helms adopted that young man? I said, I'd feel terrible. He said, well, Joe, they did. And he said, Joe, something I learned a long time ago, it's never inappropriate to challenge the judgment of another man or woman. But it's never appropriate to question their motive because you don't know. You may think you know. And when you challenge their motive, you make it almost impossible to get to go. You make it almost impossible to reach an agreement. Today, and by the way, when Jesse died, Chris Dodd and I were the only two Democrats who went to the funeral. I think you were there. They walked out. It was a big Baptist church. They walked out in a receiving room. Dot and his beautiful daughters, bright kids, and this now 55-year-old man on crutches. And they all walked, not to me, or not to the Republic. They all walked up to me. And they said, Joe, we had your signs on our lawn this election. Obama Biden for president. My point is, before Jesse died, he asked me to do the foreword for his book. The point is that you know, we don't listen to each other much anymore. And nobody disagreed more on civil rights and civil liberties than Jesse and Joe Biden. Now I'm making him a relative, but but you know, it's too much invective now. And it's awful hard. you know, it's awful hard to generate a consensus on just about anything. And it worries me. And it worries me, and I'll conclude by saying that's what worries me about this election. What worries me about this election is it looks like an election that's going to be conducted that is frontal assault on the other person. And I'm not sure even when there is the substantive arguments being made, how much you'll be listened to by the press. And we got to get by this place. We really do, for the sake of the country. We got to get by it. And anyway.
Yep. Gets back to your wonderful poets, where the falcon can't hear the falconer, the center will not hold. Is there anything we can do to bring back a way for the center to hold?
I think so. First of all, I look out at Senator Warner and other members here.
Amy.
And Amy, I already mentioned Amy, is that I think the vast majority of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and the House know better. And this is a case where it's sort of the tail wagging the dog a little bit here. But because of the way we Democrats as well, the way we've gerrymandered House districts where there's, you don't have to worry about anything from except a challenge from your right if you're Republican, your left if you're a Democrat. Because of the ability to put, and I don't want to sound like a purist here, but the ability to put enormous amounts of money in on a single candidate, $4, $5, $10 million, if they move from the orthodoxy of the far left or the far right in the parties, it makes it awful hard. I really think that we've made, my friends in the Senate have made a tragic mistake that is going to last for a while on refusal to hold a hearing on the Supreme Court justice. Now, by the way, it's not because it'll just be repeated, you know. And so I called 17 of my Republican friends, and I say that, I mean, they're genuinely my friends in the Senate. And all but three said, Joe, I know you're right. I know you're right. But, Joe, if I break, it's going to cause me this problem or that problem, whatever. Joe, if it breaks, we'll break with you. We'll be there. But don't ask me to be the first person to do this. And I understand that. But what I don't understand is why a couple haven't broken. I don't understand why you'd want a job where you have to get up, if it's true, and take a position different than you believe 20%, 30%, 40% of the time, and still want that job.
Wow.
I mean, it's not about being honorable or it's just why the hell would you want that job? No, I'm serious. I'm deadly earnest because, I mean, I can tell you, as when the Washington Post, when I did my financial disclosure, when I as vice president, they said, quote, it's probable no man has ever assumed the office of vice president with fewer assets than Joe Biden. I assume they meant financial. I may not. But I, you know, you can do a lot better. You can do a lot better out there than in here financially. And so I just don't quite get it right now.
Sam says we're could have more time, so I'm going to actually let a couple people raise their hands, and I'll call on them if you want. Yes, the person hardest.
Well, I will not be offended if you get up and leave.
The person hardest for the microphone to get. I always do that. identify yourself, please.
I'm Rachel Richards with Picken County here, and welcome to our community. We're really glad to have you here in the Institute, who does so many fabulous things for us. I wanted to go briefly back to the cancer issue to ask, it's my understanding that in the European Union, where there is single-payer health care, the health system gets more concerned with the causes of cancer and the potential contaminants within our society and chemicals and so on. But here we're kind of more siloed, where, you know, you go to the medical community when you're sick, but they're not really looking for the various environmental causes. How do we break that wall and that silo down between causation and treatment?
Well, I think we are, by the way. There's an awful lot going on now. For example, they're at MD Anderson, at in Baltimore, at, I'm trying to think of the other major, I think it's the Hutch. I know Hopkins, I'm thinking the Hutch out in Washington State. They are
Mount
working.
Sinai. We're going to give Kim Davis a shout out too for doing that. Yeah.
Y'all are working on being able to conduct tests that are blood tests, in effect, to determine whether or not you have a cancer marker in your bloodstream that can give advance notice by a long shot as to whether or not you're likely to develop cancer. I was out at the Huntsman Institute. They've come up with a way, with others have as well, determine hereditary causes of colon cancer. And now what they have is they're notifying people so that they can have, instead of the colonoscopy once every 2 years, this cadre of people will be able to live a hell of a lot longer because they'll be able to go in and have colonoscopies, and there's changes in colonoscopies, by the way, every 6 months or so. They're going to live longer. So we're doing both here. We're not just focusing on one side or the other. But if you want to, if you could wave a wand, you only got to do one thing, deal with one of the problems of cancer. If you said, if I could deal with prevention and get a response, you'd eliminate 50% of the cancers that occur in the United States of America. 50% of the cancers. A, dealing with the air, the water, what you eat, what you smoke, what your dietary habits are. They're gigantic, gigantic, gigantic impact on cancer. One of the things we're doing in this moonshot is we are trying to bring together a whole group of folks to cooperate. Like, I just went out to Cleveland, the Cleveland Clinic in Case Western, along with GW Health Facility, because the incidence of smoking are higher in both of those communities, D.C. and Cleveland, than there are other places. And if you're able to get folks exposed to lung cancer, tested whether they have lung cancer, you can save a whole lot of lives. There's setting up mobile vans. There's a lot of things we can do. But we also can't walk away. If you just did this based on numbers, there's a lot of basically orphan cancers out there that kill 250,000 people out of the 600,000 who are dying every year. The million, there's a total of cancers. I think it's 14 million people get cancer this year, and 1 point some die of cancer. I mean, so what we're trying to do, and there's no reason why we can't, is try to do all of it, because we have enough disciplines to deal with it all without taking away from or impacting upon any one of the initiatives, whether it's prevention, better diagnostics, whether it's better treatment. We can do it all. We can do it all. And by the way, money is not our biggest problem. Reorganizing the way in which we attack cancer is a gigantic, gigantic, gigantic change that has to take place in order for us to have this sense of urgency. I know I'm always viewed as, I don't know, I'm often viewed as being a little too passionate and a little too, but you know, there are thousands and thousands of people, as I speak today, were turning to their doc and say, "Doc, can you give me just so I can see my daughter get married? Doc, Doc, can I get by? Can I get by for another 8 months and see my granddaughter graduate? Doc, can I get this? Just give me, can I get another 2 months? Because if deals come through, I'll be able to pay off my home and my wife will not be left in debt. Doc." And there's so many things that we can do right now that can extend life a little bit. Also, reach real cures. And there's no reason why we have to do it. We have to choose among the various disciplines we're going to focus on, in my view.
Thank you. There was one way in the back who's been waving his hand, and you get the last question. So, because we need an ankle biter to send us off.
How do you think the next president and vice president can achieve and improve on your cancer treatments?
Well, I tell you what, I'll answer the question if you make me one promise. When you're president, and I can buy with my great-grandchildren, and they say Joe Biden's out there, you won't say Joe who, okay? What a bright young guy. How old are you?
10. I'm 10.
How old?
I'm 10.
Oh, you're getting old, man. Double figures. Well, I think we can do two things. One of the things that I was excited about in the Cancer Moonshot, and that, Greg, what, 260 off-site cancer, 270, with over 7,000 people, serious docs and patient groups, et cetera, all over America, from Guam to Puerto Rico, and thousands of people assembled for the first time ever at the request of the government. And all the stakeholders are there. I hope we've done one thing. We have re-energized the notion that an awful lot is possible, making sure that everybody understands that there's so much we can do. And I hope we've come forward with 38 changes we've offered, about 20 of them on the federal government side of the ledger. For example, you know, if we make these changes, the next president's going to be in a much better position to make some of the moves that have to be made. For example, if you go into an old diner or you go into a bar and you put money in a jukebox, you don't have to work out whether you're going to have a song played or whether you have a licensing agreement with that artist to be able to have the song played. Well, right now, you have literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of drugs in trial right now, developed by various companies and individuals in research. And so what happens is you have a lot of bright young and not so young researchers saying, if we took a combination of these three drugs and combined them together, we would be able to impact exponentially on that particular cancer that's being treated. But to get that done now, what happens is you have to reach, you can get agreement as to what you want to get this done. NIH will sign off on you being able to do that. But then you got to go work out an agreement with each of the companies relating to intellectual property and a whole range of other things. When we put a new thing in place that is going to, I think, have a real impact. NIH is negotiating with, and so far, we have 9 or 10 biopharmaceutical firms signed up, an awful lot of the biggest philanthropies, an awful lot of the hospitals, where there's now hundreds of drugs in trial. And they've already worked out the mechanism that how they would share and protect their investment in each of the drugs that they produced. So you don't have to work out a licensing agreement with them. And this will go from taking a year to a year and a half to be able to get permission to move with dual therapies, to be able to do it in 3 months. And that's going to affect a lot of people's lives somewhere. I can't predict where or how or who, but it's going to increase the sense of urgency of moving forward. There's a whole range of things we can do where we can move much more rapidly. At the federal level, we can move much more rapidly, where we get CMS more engaged in carrying the cost of some things, where we can get NIH more responsive directly so that they're going, taking chances earlier on with younger folks who are in. Right now, you want to get a grant, you have to be in a lab of somebody very established and be there for a long time in order to qualify, et cetera. There's ways we can speed up without in any way negatively impacting on safety or security or proprietary rights that can just move this whole train down the track faster. And I think even people who don't like how hard I'm pushing on some of these things, you ask them, I think they'll tell you privately, yeah, we can move a whole lot faster. We can move a whole lot faster. Some don't like moving faster because it's not going to be them that did it. It's not going to be that individual who did it. Because there's not... Shared science is not... If you're an astrophysicist and you want a grant from DARPA or from the space agency, and you get that grant and you decide on, you find some breakthrough on whether it's Saturn rings or water on Mars, whatever, you got to make that information immediately available on the web to everybody who wants it so they can all benefit from it. You do that in, what was the one was done, the cancer breakthrough, and it was instead of Science Magazine doing it, when the genome was finally cracked, the decision was where to publish all this information. And Science Magazine, which is more prestigious, didn't want it unless they had a proprietary interest in who could have access to it. So it was published in Nature Magazine. I'm serious. Now, as my brother would say, go figure. Imagine keeping that information under wraps for another year or year and a half because some proprietary interest. In the field of cancer, that year makes a difference between someone living and dying, whether they live another 3 months or 6 days or whatever. And so all we're trying to do is within the range of reason, speed up the process in a way that in no way compromises public health, safety, or security, does not go in and attempt to deny the benefits that should flow from the research and the development done by an individual or a company, but has some rational basis to it. You're awful kind. Thank you also very much.
I want to say one thing personally. In all of my years, Vice President Biden is the person I most like and most respect in national public life. It's true. You're a great man. Thank you. God bless you. God bless Kitty Boone. And God bless America on its 240th birthday. Thank you, sir.